Today, on the second of two Sundays focusing on stewardship, we have a gospel story that is just classic when it comes to morality tales on good stewardship. It's a go-to story when a preacher wants to encourage generous giving, and church finance committees just eat it up. When the preacher chooses this story to expound on when budgets are tight or the fiscal year is winding down or for some other reason, they want us to be thinking about money. Oh, is this the Sunday that we bring back our faith promises? Ha! Who knew? What a coincidence. This story of taking what we are given and investing it in the work of God's kingdom is, all joking aside, an appropriate story to read and think about. There are good lessons to be learned in this text. Lessons on wise use of resources, lessons on using our varied gifts for God's mission, lessons on valuing everyone's gift, no matter how large or small. Good stuff. But in the context of inspiring us to meet a church budget, something doesn't sit quite right. Is the message of the parable as obvious as we who think about church finances would like to believe? As far as inspiring generosity toward the church, I think we can get there from here, but it's not a direct path. I think we jump there a little too quickly and a little too self-servingly. So let's step back from these present facts that we at Parkview have to finish 2017 in the black. We need to draw up a balanced spending plan for next year, and we need to figure out how to pay for a major building fix. When Jesus told this story, I don't think he had, even in the farthest reaches of his mind, any thought about the need for funding for the work of the temple in Jerusalem and the high costs associated with temple life and worship. In fact, this story about bags of gold has nothing to do with money. The gold was a metaphor. I think what makes it so clear that it's not about real gold or a lesson about actual money is that the whole premise of the story, if we look at it through a financial lens, is utterly ridiculous. It makes no sense as a money story. Metaphors need to be read as metaphors and not taken literally. We know that. Like, when someone undertakes the most ambitious project of their lives, they might comment that this is their moonshot. The appropriate response to that comment is not, "Sounds great, John, but there's a lot more to getting to the moon than you realize. Have you been in touch with NASA?" See, we can recognize our metaphors pretty easily. It can be a little trickier recognizing biblical metaphors. But here is one, and let me unpack it. First, a quick review of the story itself again. The master goes away on a trip, calls three of his servants to care for the things while he's gone. One faithful servant is given 5 talents of gold, a whole lot of money, and he exercises good stewardship of what was given, invests it wisely, doubles on the investment, returns it to the master, and gets a reward. Second is given 2, still a heap of money, and he's also a good steward, doubles it, returns it, gets a reward. Third servant gets 1 talent, still a huge amount of money. But he's not a good steward. He's short-sighted, self-centered, buries it in the ground. When the master returns, the servant gives it back the way he got it. The servant is taken to task. Okay, so what do we see here? First of all, we see this is not really a story about some workers and what they produced or failed to produce. It's a story about the relationship between a master and three slaves. We are told that the master, quote, entrusted his property, unquote, to his slaves. Entrusted his property. That statement in itself, without anything else being said, should make us sit up and say, ah, metaphor. That would not happen in real life. Just the liquid assets, the gold, was substantial. This master was a one percenter, you might say. One talent was worth 15 years of wages for the average laborer. And one of the slaves got 5 talents. Do the math. It would be like the owner of a fast food chain taking 3 of his minimum wage employees and handing them nearly $2 million. Would any master in their right mind have entrusted this massive wealth to 3 underpaid laborers? This is the kind of trust you might put in a close family member. If not a son or daughter, maybe a business-savvy niece or nephew. And if not family, surely there was someone on his level, another property owner, a business colleague, an investment broker, someone with experience handling huge amounts of money. Then the story might make sense. As it stands, it's nonsense. And all of Jesus' listeners would know immediately that he's building up a metaphor here. The facts of the story are fantasy, but he's going somewhere with this story. So they're willing to listen to see how the story progresses. 2 of the slaves responded exactly the way the master had hoped, with gratitude, with responsibility, with action. 5 talents became 10, 2 became 4. These slaves accepted their master's amazing gift of trust, and they trusted him in return. But the 3rd slave dug a hole in the ground, and he buried not only his master's property, he buried the relationship of trust that was offered. When the master returned, the slave said to his face, I didn't trust you. I knew you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow, so I hid the money. The master showed enough trust and confidence in this slave to place in his hands $250,000, $250,000, 15 years of flipping hamburgers. He trusted the slave to invest it for him, but the slave couldn't perceive that. The slave could not accept this gift of trust in him because he had already decided not to trust the master. Now, maybe the master had indeed done some things that, in the eyes of the slave, seemed to be harsh and unfair. But as a servant, his first obligation was to serve the master, not to undermine the master's work. And one could wonder how a master could be as cruel and heartless as claimed and still exhibit so much trust and confidence in his lowest servants. How could someone so unjust and so self-serving have that much faith in persons under his total control? Another reason why this story is an over-the-top metaphor is the master was offering the slave a partnership. That's unheard of in master-slave relationships. The master was the senior partner in this relationship, of course. I'm not suggesting that the balance of power was equal. But the master was offering a certain degree of mutuality here. Both parties gave and received. The master needed what the slaves had to offer. He was going on a long trip. His wealth needed to be managed. He needed someone he could trust. And the slaves, of course, needed the resources of the master. On their own, without any capital, they could never have survived, much less become successful entrepreneurs. This was a mutually beneficial partnership here. And what made it work was trust. The master trusted his slaves by putting his wealth in their hands, and the two slaves trusted their master by devoting all their time and energy to fulfilling his wishes. They trusted that in the end, he would treat them right. That's why the third slave was punished so severely. He rejected this relationship of trust that the master extended to him. That's why in the end, this parable doesn't work very well as a straight-up lesson on wise investing and personal stewardship. Sorry about that, Finance Committee. But I have to say that the slave, I don't think the slave was punished because his talent didn't earn enough. He wasn't punished because of poor investing choices. I think if he had received the gift with the same attitude as the others and gone out and invested it as best he knew how, he would have earned the approval of the master even if he was not able to double on the investment. Even if his management skills were not up to par. Even if he had made some unwise investment decisions and the bottom dropped out of the market and he ended up giving back to the master even less than he had at the start. Not everyone is able to be a shining success in business. If the servant had gratefully received the gift of trust and showed some trust in return, even if he failed miserably, I believe there would have been grace. The servant was punished because he scorned the master's gift. He rejected the trust the master placed in him. He disrespected both the gift and the giver. Keeping in mind that this parable and most other parables of Jesus were stories about the kingdom of God, I think we're best to read them through that lens. This is not a story about funding temple worship. It's not about being smart with money. This is a story about orienting your whole life toward God in a posture of trust, of self-giving, of generous openness and hospitality, of risk-taking for the sake of the kingdom of God. God has entrusted us with much more than we deserve as laborers. The gift of $250,000 pales in comparison to the many and varied gifts that our loving God has given to us in life. God has given all these gifts that we have, has given them in trust. God is this master who entrusted his servants to look after all these things that God still owns, but is handed to us in trust. We are God's trustees. As low-level laborers, we did nothing to earn that trust. The trust is a gift, pure and simple. God is still owner of all our resources. Ownership has not been transferred. But the trust, that is a free and unencumbered gift. We can do with that gift whatever we choose. We can treasure the trust that God has given us and live accordingly, returning that trust to God. By so doing, we create a circle of trust. God trusts us, we trust God, and God's agenda gets accomplished. Or we can do as a third servant and break the circle of trust. The quantity of gifts is not the issue. Whether we start with one or two or five or 10, it matters not. Exactly what kind of gifts they are matters not. Whether we successfully double the investment matters not. It's the trust that matters. Have we returned the gift of trust? Do we trust God sufficiently to invest our gifts in God's enterprise? We know what God's enterprise is about. God's mission on earth is the same now as it always has been. God is building a kingdom of peace, of healing, of shalom. God's mission is to make broken things whole. God's mission is to turn violence and death into life and growth. God's mission is to take suffering and transform it into healing. If we use our gifts to accrue wealth and power to ourselves, if we use our gifts in a way that oppress or harm others, even if our investments multiply 100 times over, I think it's clear which of those three servants we resemble. But if we use our gifts to bring hope and reconciliation in our personal lives, in our communities, and in and through the church, if we use these gifts to nurture life and growth and bind up the wounds of the world, then when the Master returns to settle accounts, we will hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your master." So this is where we come back, in a roundabout way, to one of the important tasks that we have in the church, that of managing our financial resources well and wisely, for the sake of the kingdom. We all play a part in that collective work that we have to do as a church, whether it's participating in the faith promise process or contributing in other ways toward our collective financial stewardship. My prayer is that all of us will participate in that in a spirit of deep trust, a trust that's willing to take risks for God's sake and for the sake of God's mission. My prayer is that this trust is what is guiding your participation in the faith promise process and guiding all other decisions that you're making, how you respond to the trust that God has placed in you with your money, with your relationships, with other resources you have. So on this Sunday before Thanksgiving, we will do our usual harvest-style offering. Instead of passing the plates, we invite everyone to come forward.